Welcome to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. Earth Matters is in Santa Fe this week, and we're delighted to have with us attorney Denise Ford. Denise has an extensive background in environmental and natural resources law, 40 years of practice, politics, reflecting and writing about policies, all animated by a belief that society must turn toward a more sustainable relationship with its environment. She believes that law plays a critical role in establishing the institutions that govern those relationships. Good morning, Denise, and welcome to Earth Matters.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Glad you could join us. So, Denise, you have a tremendous amount of experience with environmental and natural resource use decisions here in New Mexico and as well at the national and international levels. Tell us where you think we are as a society in protecting our environment and natural resources. Are we moving forward or heading backwards in creating a more sustainable society?
That should be a much simpler question to answer than it is. I think in some of the things I have been doing this for a while, and you know, at the time the big environmental laws were passed, it really was true that you couldn't see across Los Angeles. I remember that when I grew up on the Potomac River, if you got a few drops of it on it, you would sting your skin to have such a polluted water on you. And so some of the pollution programs have really been very effective, and I think the consciousness of people is very, very different than it was when these laws were initiated. At the same time, David Brower used to talk about how many people were on the planet when he was born. Well, there were about 2 billion on the planet when I was born. We have 7.5 billion now. And so a lot of questions about sustainability have to do with simply the number of people and the amount of resources that we're consuming. That pushes us away from a sustainable trajectory. And then, of course, overshadowing all of this is climate change. And if we were to continue on the path we are now with respect to emissions, then we know that we're definitely looking at a future which is untenable for many people on the globe, and certainly for many species.
Yeah, and you've said that our system of laws plays a critical role in environmental protection and conservation of our natural resources. So explain to us, how does that work?
Well, it's really funny. Law school admissions, go up and down with the new TV show or something like that. Well, with the new administration and the success that environmental lawyers have had in a number of cases in stopping illegal suspension of regulations, rollback of regulations, and so on, we apparently have a bump in law school admissions. So people are seeing that law can be a block on illegal, unconstitutional executive action. And that is causing people to look towards law school and look favorably, I think, on the role of law in our society. Law is one of the, it is one of the things that distinguishes us from an authoritarian regime. And we do still have a healthy and independent judiciary. And we have, I think, widespread but not universal respect for the institutions that undergird our entire society.
Yeah, one thing I think that's difficult in using environmental law, I'm thinking particularly the Gila River diversion decision. It's like rivers, the environment, don't really have a voice or standing necessarily in our legal system. How does that work? How does it work? How should we be looking at these issues from a legal perspective?
It's true that there was a book, Should Trees Have Standing, written at the initiation of really the era of environmental law, which, by the way, really started in our country, and so it's something about which we can be proud. No, trees don't have standing as such, nor do rivers, nor does an endangered species. People do, and in most cases, people can make the successfully persuade a court that their interests might be affected. Not in every case, though, and we've had some. There's definitely some within the judiciary who would want to narrow the concept of standing, those who can bring forth a legal argument. But in general, it's a matter, as we say, of good pleading that one is able to identify the interests. Taking your question at another level, though, we don't, in our country and in our legal systems, we don't really yet value ecological functions. We don't value rivers as such, and we see the results of this. And just when people talk about rivers and they say, "Oh, everything's just fine with water," and you know, if you turn on your tap, water's going to come out, and they're not thinking about the rivers that have simply been dried up, the springs that have been dried up. They're not thinking about the species that have gone extinct because of their habitat has been destroyed. So in a deeper way, we don't, in our legal system, we really don't value rivers, we don't value areas the way we should.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And of course, politics comes into play in these natural resource use decisions, environmental decisions. And you know, in addition to being an attorney, Denise, you are a very savvy political strategist. How does it come into play in the environmental policy arena? And really for communities, how do communities really do or achieve what's best for them when our political space is just so divided and contentious?
That's a large question. Let me start with a couple different levels of politics. I guess one of the things that I've observed from almost my entire legal career and advocacy career, being in New Mexico, but a little bit of it in California, is that, you know, the states vary so much in their capacity and their willingness to protect the environment and to protect ecology, protect broader interests. And one thing that political scientists have learned that isn't surprising is that poor states are less likely to protect the environment than affluent states. And so New Mexicans support environmental protection, and we like clean air and clean water, and we like to go and be in the outdoors. But our elected officials seem to feel the pull of what they believe the economic interests that would benefit from degrading the environment. And we see that right now in the battle over methane emissions as an example. So part of the political system is, do we get better protection at the federal level? Do we get better protection at the state level? Over a period of time, you know, we can see, depends. And so we want to have strong people who get environmental issues in the state legislature. And then we want to have them at the county level. We want to have them at town and city level. We want to have them within tribal governments, because each of these entities can very much play a positive or negative role. And as we'll be talking about with the Trump administration and its attitude towards climate change, we're looking towards cities now, and we're seeing progress. So people live in cities. And so if cities can do things, then the national attitude becomes somewhat less important.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like the political discourse is just so divisive. I'm wondering, do you see any way to kind of bring people together and find common ground on some of these environmental issues, especially climate change?
I think we have to do so. You know, we started, of course, as you know, when the EPA started, and so many of the major environmental laws were supported by the Republicans in the Congress. There were leading Republican senators who worked for that legislation. President Nixon signed much of it into law. There's absolutely no reason, inherent reason, that I see that environmental protection would be a partisan issue. And it's quite an interesting progression that's gotten us to this point.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I wonder, do you think that people just don't really remember what things were like in the 60s or 70s, like the Cuyahoga River burning or LA's bad pollution, like you had mentioned earlier, and don't really recognize the role that our environmental laws have played in cleaning things up?
Well, I think in general, actually, most people do appreciate both a good clean environment, and they appreciate the institutions and the laws that got us there. It's a really you know, right now the attacks that are going under that are underway in Washington against EPA, that's a very small group of people, and you know, they're a minority within a minority who feel that way. And you know, Steve Bannon, I don't really know the man, and I don't know his you know, academic writings and so on. But one gathers when he says he wants to deconstruct the regulatory state. You know, he has something in mind that I very few people in the country would agree. We benefit. We like the thought that people who are out driving have driver's licenses, and we like the thought that buildings don't fall down because they had inspections, and you know, we like the thought that when we turn on the tap, our water is safe to drink. You know, I the notion that you would do away with the regulatory state is a really, really insider stuff. But the particular group that's benefiting from that right now is the fossil fuel industry, and you know, the Koch brothers' role is often pointed to in terms of coal money that is supported by coal. Some of the large oil and gas interests are obviously very happy with the attacks that are going on the methane regulation. So this deregulation concept, I think, has successfully been sold by a small group of people, both people who are ideological, like Steve Bannon, and those who have direct economic interests and benefit from it. And I really don't think, and there's lots of evidence to indicate that that's by no means a majority of people.
Right, and I think there was a regulatory sort of public comment period that was open for soliciting public input on streamlining environmental regulations. And I'd say the vast majority of those comments were in support of existing environmental regulations rather than rolling them back. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of comments. And I think polling has showed that too, in terms of the vast majority of Americans are supporting environmental regulations. Well, Denise, you know, you have been a trailblazer throughout your career, and you headed up the predecessor organization to the New Mexico Environment Department at a very young age and as a woman. What are some of the challenges that you've been confronted with in those positions? How have you dealt with them? And do you have any advice for women who might be contemplating pursuing a legal career?
It has fortunately, I think it's changed quite a bit. Yes, it was really, I was actually the second environmental lawyer in the state on behalf of the environment when I moved here. And as a very young woman talking about these things, I was actually attacked in many different sorts of ways. It's when I look back on these things, it's almost hard, because we do really now, we accept taxation and we accept, you know, many aspects of modern life, of which environmental regulation is one. But I was fortunate in some of those positions to have a boss, Governor Tony Anaya, who said to me, "You just do what's the right thing. You do what's moral and ethical, and you know, let the chips fall where they may." And so, when I was at the Environment Department, people would come in a few times a year and ask that I, like Molly Corr, ask that I be fired. And you know, various people would make the industries would make the pilgrimage to the governor's office to ask that I be fired. But I was fired a few times, but not by Tony directly. So I stayed in there. But I guess I do think if one has some internal sense of what's motivating one, then those sorts of attacks, while never pleasant, weren't devastating to me. And then it's been so nice to have the, you know, so many bright people who have joined the environmental movement. There's so much more room for people to do that work, even within New Mexico, a very small state, that it's nice now to feel like there's a whole community of people who are active.
Great. Well, Denise, we'll be right back after this quick break and continue our conversation with environmental and natural resources attorney Denise Forrest. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and your host for today's program. We're talking about environmental policy with my guest today, environmental and natural resource attorney Denise Fort, who is professor emerita at the UNM Law School. Denise, you're a long-term mover and shaker on water policy here in New Mexico, as well as more broadly in the West. you served as director of the Water Resources Administration Program at UNM and also as chair of the Western Water Policy Review Advisory Committee, which is a presidential panel appointed to review the role of the federal government in Western water issues. So I'm curious, given your state level, but as well as more broadly, your Western perspective, I'm curious about your thoughts about how we're doing regarding planning and managing our water resources.
So the Western Water Policy Review Advisory Commission, a mouthful, was a federal commission that was established by Senator Hatfield, actually, and Senators Bill Bradley in 1992, and then President Clinton appointed the members. And it was a fascinating kind of snapshot of where is federal water policy at that time. And I've been a pretty close observer of federal water policy since that time. I think that we don't see a lot of major changes happening at the federal level, and that's not a good thing, given population growth in the western United States, given the mining of groundwater aquifers, and again, given climate change, just as a few examples. So we haven't really seen kind of breakthrough thinking. There's been a desire, I think, even in the Obama administration, which many of us look back fondly on, but there really was seemed to be a desire to play things pretty close, low-key during that time. And so where the real action's been happening again has been mostly on the state level. You know, the drought that hit California really turned things upside down. And California is a state that is more accustomed to change and to making changes and following through on that. So we've seen more innovation within California. We've seen it within some of the other Western states. But your question about how we're doing overall, I'd have to say that we are not, the West as a whole isn't prepared to respond to all of these forces, but climate change would be primary among them.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking about under the Obama administration, the Bureau of Reclamation sort of having a strategic plan that was supposed to be emphasizing more conservation as opposed to big dams and diversions. Is that still kind of the policy direction under the Trump administration? Do we know yet? I mean, I know a lot of the political appointees still haven't even been appointed yet. So do we know a direction?
I don't think we do have a direction, except I think we can assume that there's going to be more of an emphasis on storage. However, and we have seen, you know, within California, we have seen one essentially breakthrough in the direction of what used to be called the peripheral canal. The issue that I think underlies all of this in Western water is agricultural use of water. And that so quickly gets complicated because it is, you know, by far where the greatest amount of water goes. It's gets tied back to the question of our diets, but it actually gets tied back to global diets. And, you know, the story of the Saudi Arabians buying dairy farms in Arizona, which kind of boggles the mind. Could this be true? But it really is true that as dairy, which has all sorts of environmental consequences and is very high in water consumption, as that becomes part of an international diet, then that affects water use and demand for water in the U.S. And similarly, you know, growing alfalfa in New Mexico and growing it west-wide as the ships are going back to China with alfalfa in them. And so it's what the world is eating. There are all sorts of economic policies that drive those questions of what the world eats. But it does say that the U.S., with respect to our water, I'm sounding like this might be one area where the U.S. should really be looking out for its own interests. And with respect to our water, we probably don't want to be shipping our water away in the form of alfalfa. And for New Mexico, mining our groundwater to grow alfalfa, which we feed to dairy cattle, in turn, we are shipping our water in the form of milk products. We're shipping it somewhere else. And so it just gets so complicated that even the terms really conservation doesn't really capture it. It's are we doing things now with our water that are going to make sense 100 years from now? Are we going to say, did we think we had so much water that we could mine groundwater for purposes of growing alfalfa for dairy cattle? And I think the answer is going to be no.
Right, yeah. And so speaking of New Mexico, how are we doing in terms of, are we doing adequate planning for securing our water future, especially in the context of climate change and long-term drought?
I think the answer there, again, might depend on from whose, not from the perspective of the rivers, as we spoke about, from the rivers that don't have a voice. I think we continue to believe that there will be rescue projects which will involve the transport of water. You know, of course, our big cities are now using San Juan Chama water, so we're using Colorado River water, in essence, to rescue us. And then we're looking at, you know, people have ideas of pipelines that they could run all over the state for one purpose or another to rescue people from, you know, from decisions that are being made or were made some number of years ago that have affected water supply. But somebody who takes a different position on this might say, well, it's still going to be the case that when you turn your tap on in a city 50 years from now, water will flow. And I think that's probably correct. The question we might ask from an environmental perspective, from a community perspective, any number of others would be at what cost. But I do think the water will continue to flow. And so the water experts in the state are smart, and you know the water planners are smart, and they're good at what they do. But it's within a narrow framework that says the goal is to essentially meet municipal water demands.
Right, and sort of balancing between ag needs in a rural state with a very much a agricultural cultural base, and seeing, you know, the potential for water transfers from rural agricultural areas to urban areas. It seems like there's a lot of discussion about that and mm-hmm. these interbasin transfers. How, especially, for instance, the Augustine Plains Ranch application, or even the Gila diversion, which I think is now being discussed in the context of exporting water out of the region. So how do you respond to that?
Well, one level of response to it is just to say that the user should pay. And the entities, as in the case of the Gila and in the case of the Augustine proposed transfer, in both of those cases, the entities that are developing the water, so-called, think that somebody else should pay for the value of the water. There's big costs in there, hundreds of millions of dollars and greater and greater. And their expectation is that state government will step in and bail them out, in effect, and give the benefits of the project to somebody else. And if we just said that, you know, as somebody who might live on some property and you'd have your own well, and you'd pretty much expect that you're going to take care of your own well, and if you and your neighbors need to deepen your wells, you're going to pay to deepen your wells, and so on. There's that expectation. But at the bigger state level, we are really in this form of kind of the worst of kind of socialism, that the state and entities and are going to pay for whatever needs to be paid for. That's at least is the expectation, or the federal government's going to pay for it. And so the people who benefit, the ones who develop the water, even the ones who use the water, aren't taking those, don't have to take those costs into account. And I think that would be true of the Ute Lake project. It'd be true of the ones that you'd mentioned. And it would tend to be true statewide that we're all looking that someone else is going to pay these big costs.
Do you think, I know there have been some, David Brookshire comes to mind, of, you know, some of this economic modeling to look at how to set up water markets so that you can maybe try and reflect, have markets that reflect the true value of water. What do you think? Will those work be realistic in New Mexico in the future, or quite honestly anywhere? Well, I know there's a lot of resistance to those types of economic models.
And are you speaking specifically of allowing markets, having markets work as well, which we really have, which we've only done in a very, very limited way within the state? You know, I look to Australia as another example that I think that we've actually dabbled with a little bit in New Mexico, but essentially in Australia, the federal government bought back water rights, and then it auctions them on a yearly basis to those who can use the water, but it first sets aside a minimum flow for environmental purposes. They recognize the ecological benefits of the Murray-Darling Basin, the river systems. They recognize the benefits to the country as a whole, and then they auction off the water above that amount. And so it means that agriculture becomes more efficient. Municipal users have an incentive to conserve, and so on. Could that work in New Mexico? We just have to get to this point in the first place where, as I said, we move away from the notion that someone else is going to pay. And I think as long as we've got that out there, even if you were interested in a market, you'd have to know it could be, you know, a political decision could come in at any point and could undercut whatever you thought you could do on more of a market basis. And we're somewhere in between. There are people who are fighting against water privatization, and I almost think it's kind of a misnomer, because water is private to some large degree within the state. But we've also got this enormous governmental interference. So if you were a real private marketeer, then you wouldn't be looking for a handout from the state or federal government at the same time. I'm not answering your question.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting. It's not clear cut, really.
It isn't clear cut. I think what we should do is we should start with water has to be in a public trust, in the sense, not talking legally, but just about what kind of place we want to live in. We want to start with the assumption that we've got healthy rivers and functioning ecosystems. We want to start with equity, that people who live in a community that isn't served by water should be able to be served by water. We want people to have clean water. We want some expectations into the future that we're not, you know, going to have to desert our homes and leave because there isn't water 50 years from now. And so I think that's what I was trying to bring out about the Australian system, is they went back and they rebuilt their water system, asking, what do we want to achieve? It hasn't been perfect, lots of critics, but I think we're starting at the other end where big government projects are coming in, private entrepreneurs are coming in, but with the expectation of big government projects helping them. And we haven't really articulated as civil society, for everybody who, you know, doesn't own a big water project, we haven't asked for civil society, what are our goals for the environment in which we live, of which water for New Mexicans is the most important element, and what do we want from it?
Do you think public welfare statements in the regional water plans kind of serve that purpose? They're locally specific statements of what the vision is.
They are statements, and of course, as you know, water plans, I'm not going to say that they're that, and, you know, $5 will buy you a latte, but they're not in and of themselves, that they don't lead to, and they're not self-implementing. And I think there's always been a question. As you know, they weren't, the whole regional water planning wasn't done from a perspective of what do we want so much. It was done to protect our water against export. And as it's gone forward in some regions, it's really nice and healthy what the participation's been, the relationship with the state government in actually expounding the plans has been a question, but the biggest question has been, what does it mean to, you know, should they, how could they be implemented? And this is where, you know, when I talk about privatization, it remains the case in New Mexico that the powerful players are those who own water or have the money to buy it. And if you're a citizen who participated in regional water planning, it's a very good thing to have done, and one hopes those citizen voices carry forward into decision making. We're not finished just because it's been put in the plan. There's going to be a struggle to make it carry forward.
So, one other question about rivers having voices, so to speak. I'm curious about the strategic water reserve and keeping water in the river for the river. Can you tell us, because you were involved in getting this legislation, this policy put in place. So tell us what the Strategic Water Reserve is.
Yeah, that was actually something that Think New Mexico and a Santa Fe group with participation around the state came up with a lot of people commenting on it. And the notion would be that state government would be able to dedicate water to the river, not even necessarily on a permanent basis. It is back to that ownership model. It's got to be actual water rights. I think what it says to me, and something that's heartening that comes out of it, is that people within the state water establishment and within, you know, those who are water practitioners and other levels of government recognize that, yeah, we want to have living rivers. We want, you know, we want to have some minimum flows in our rivers. It's not acceptable. People talk about a social contract. It's not acceptable to denude a river entirely of water. And so there, surely we can, and we have in the case of the Strategic River Reserve, we can come up with a means by which we can protect flows. That said, you know, you are, you know, a mile from the dry Santa Fe River, and you know, we've seen people walking in the Rio Grande on occasion. So it's not working within New Mexico, but at least we have set up one small tool that could be used to restore water to our rivers.
Okay, we'll be right back after this short break and continue our conversation about water, the environment, and climate change with environmental and natural resource attorney Denise Fort. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and your host for today's program. My guest is Denise Fort, an environmental and natural resource attorney based in Santa Fe. Denise is chair of the Energy and Climate Change Committee for the Rio Grande chapter of the Sierra Club and went to the recent UN Climate Change Conference in Marrakesh, Morocco back in November of 2016 as a representative of the National Sierra Club. So, Denise, with President Trump's decision to drop out of the Paris Climate Agreement, what does this mean about our ability as a global community to make progress toward emission reductions needed to stabilize our climate? Where are we on this now? Very disappointing.
It is very disappointing. You know, the United States is responsible by volume for most of the emissions, the largest volume of emissions of greenhouse gases. You know, we are the ones, of course, as the industrialized nation with this standard of living in which we, you know, if you went to Europe and saw how much they paid for gasoline or how people lived and so on, we were the ones who were living large in the U.S. and we really in many ways bear the responsibility for creating this problem. We have great science here in the United States, so we understand the problem. We've got people in governmental agencies. We have people who work for universities and other scientific institutions who understand the problem. We understand the technology of what we need to do to move in a different direction and not use fossil fuels and reduce all the other activities that contribute to global warming and to climate change. And so for Trump to have done this and to undo the work of so many people who have come before him is disappointing. It is something that is hard to hold one's head up at this time as an American because of what he did. And we look forward to the time changing when we can say the U.S. has rejoined the consensus of the remainder of the world about the importance of doing something about climate change and our ability to do something. What does it mean? Well, it really isn't clear at this moment what it means. He just sent took another step, sort of supposedly on the path to saying that we're pulling out of Paris, but actually, you know, in terms of the legal principles of the convention, it's itself, it was done so that they couldn't be done in a hasty way by a U.S. president. And even now, the administration has said that it intends to participate in some of the talks about, you know, the ongoing talks about implementation of the climate accords. And he's even said, well, you know, maybe we'd renegotiate it. And the other nations have said, no, we don't think we're going to be renegotiating it. You know, that's not where the rest of the world is now. So it's a complicated, as in so many other aspects of our public life right now, it's hard to know exactly what it means that he's announced that we're going to withdraw.
Okay, and a lot of people are talking about with the federal government maybe taking a back seat on leadership, at least at the national level, mm-hmm. on emission reductions of greenhouse gases. The states need to step up to the mm-hmm. plate. How are states doing that?
The first area we look towards, I think, is towards coal-fired power and for power plants. And that those battles are being fought out on a state-by-state level as they are within New Mexico. And so the national position, you know, the people who believed Trump when he said, I'm going to bring back coal jobs, it wasn't up to him. He's not going to bring back coal jobs. And, you know, we as a country need to help those people who are losing their jobs, who were in coal mining and working in power plants, but he's not bringing back coal. And so those decisions really have to come down with the economics of alternatives. Oil and gas development is another story. He is doing things that make both coal development on public lands, but oil and gas development on public lands easier. The fight right now over Bears Ears National Monument, a beautiful area in the Four Corners area that was set aside as a national monument by President Obama, that fight in many ways is about whether or not oil and gas development is going to happen within the monument boundaries, as it is within New Mexico as well. And so this is an administration now that is going to do everything it can to advance oil and gas development, and it does have more of an ability than it does with respect to coal. And local participation in those decisions is more limited than we'd like, although not non-existent.
Yeah, and what's the status on the methane rule now related to oil and gas drilling at the, I guess it's a BLM methane rule, right?
Both BLM and EPA were in the rulemaking, well, were addressing methane emissions on federal lands, and the administration would like to get rid of both the EPA rule and the BLM rule. And just for a reminder for everybody, methane is one of the pollutants that's associated with oil and gas development. It affects people who live near oil and gas development, along with a number of other pollutants that are present with it and that would be controlled if methane were controlled. But in addition to that, it's a greenhouse gas, and it's a very potent greenhouse gas. And so it's been pretty interesting that Congress could have but did not use kind of an obscure provision that would have allowed it to get rid of one of the methane regulations, and it didn't take the opportunity to do so. The EPA administrator is now determining whether or not he should impose some sort of moratorium on the EPA rule. Zinke, of course, is opposed to the BLM rule. So things are really, everything is in and will be in litigation about that. I think we have to turn to state government on this. Colorado enacted methane regulations. The oil and gas industry went on as before. The ceiling didn't fall. And other states, I think we will see enacting regulation. We are losing revenues through the state land office and through other taxation programs. We're losing revenues because of the escaping. Methane is just something which would be taxed as natural gas, and we're losing revenues on that. So I think we have to turn to the Oil Conservation Division and to the state legislature, to the incoming governor, to say we need the same sorts of regulations that Colorado has done. For a New Mexican's perspective, I don't think there should be much debate about this. There are jobs out there in controlling methane, and there are plenty of jobs with those who go around and take care of the facilities that are emitting it. So we're losing the revenues, we've got health effects, and then we've got the effects on the global climate as well. So let's do it. We can do it at a state level.
What other rules or what other issues are ongoing here in New Mexico that have a big impact in terms of climate change and emission reductions?
And there are definitely things we can address, some things we can address locally. You know, of course, building codes are an area where jurisdictions can make a difference. We can ask that public buildings, that new public buildings, get certification in terms of their reductions of emissions. We'd like to see people make the, I might sound like I'm a saleswoman for PNM, but we'd actually like to see the electrification, it's called, of transportation, so that over the long term, we'll no longer be using oil and for our cars, but we'll actually be plugging them into our grid, and we'll hope that that grid becomes, and we're going to work to make that grid more renewable over time. And so New Mexico needs to get on it in terms of getting plugging stations in. The VW settlement is one of the ways that we could do more of that. But I think we're also going to need legislation, and we're going to need entrepreneurs, and we're going to need the power companies. We're going to need PNM and the other power entities that provide power to provide, let people who buy electric vehicles know that they will be able to charge them. And we certainly don't want someone driving cross country to run out of fuel as they get to New Mexico. So we need to think about the interstate system and making sure that we've got EV charging on the interstate system.
Right, and thinking about the idea of the public trust in the context of climate change, wondering if you could explain sort of the concept of the public trust. It's being used right now in cases related to trying to force the federal government to take action on behalf of children and future generations, take action on climate change. So tell us more about public trust doctrine.
It's a deep part of our legal heritage, because the notion is that there are some things that inherently belong to all of us, and that they can't be privatized, they can't be given away, they can't be sold. You know, what we do with the atmosphere right now is we just let people pollute for free. They can just dump, in the case of these greenhouse gases, we let them dump them for free, and they take the entities that are doing that are taking away from something that belongs to all of us, and maybe most importantly belongs to the future, because for everyone who's thinking about what it's going to be like for future generations, you'd say, don't trash the atmosphere, don't trash the oceans, don't trash, you know, our air, don't trash our rivers. You know, these are things which should not be up to a single generation to destroy. And so the public trust is a legal concept that expresses that there is a public, that something belongs to all of us, and the term used, it's inalienable. It can't be sold, it can't be given away. So the litigation that's underway, and I think we'll have more litigation about any number of different to the atmosphere, water, and so on. We'll have more litigation trying to get at that concept. We also have it in the New Mexico Constitution. We actually have a constitutional right, as we should, to a clean environment, and we don't know how to vindicate that right. We don't know kind of legally what we do with that. But these are things that if you got Americans together and said, you know, isn't it true that we all own these things and have a stake in them? We'd say, yeah, we do. And they're too important to let anybody run away with them.
All right. Let's take a short break, and we'll talk more about climate change with environmental and natural resource attorney Denise Fort. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and your host for today's program. My guest today is environmental and natural resource attorney Denise Fort, and we've been talking about environmental law and policy. And Denise, you're involved in a new campaign called Friends of EPA. And tell us, why should we care about EPA?
Well, EPA is the agency that was started in 1970 to protect our country's environment, and it was actually, I mentioned, started under President Nixon. It is the agency that researches environmental issues, and it does promulgate regulations, but it does a whole lot besides that. It also enforces environmental regulations, but it also supports state agencies. So that's how New Mexico's Environment Department, that of other states, some tribal governments, some specific programs at our universities within the state and communities within the state are funded. It's how Superfund sites are cleaned up. So it's a major federal agency. And the reason we started this, it's a web page called friendsofepa.org. That's it. And the reason we started it is because the president's proposed budget had a 30% cut for EPA. And that was so shocking and so counter to where, you know, I thought and everyone thought the future lay for EPA. You know, this is actually an agency that needs more resources. It, you know, to slash an agency like that was really just kind of incomprehensible. But there it was in the president's budget. So across the country, people rose up. There is a group of former EPA employees out of Washington. There's another one out of Boulder that's active on this. There are lots and lots of groups within New Mexico that are responding. And the first hearing that was held in the House of Representatives on the president's budget, it was interesting because there were Republicans and there's the expression dead on arrival. Well, that budget was dead on arrival. Nobody was going to do this to EPA, but they did. Nonetheless, the House has come out with a substantial cut to EPA. What it reminds us all is we just can't take things for granted at a time like this. And there's been a longstanding organization that supports the National Parks Association. So it seems like, you know, if you work for EPA and you speak out, you're going to get transferred somewhere. Somewhere not very nice, like the Interior Department climate scientist who's now collecting royalties. You know, you know that you're in bad shape. They're pushing people out the door there. They're pushing forced layoffs. So you're not going to work for EPA and speak out for EPA. It's going to have to be people, you know, who don't work for the agency or used to work for the agency who say, wait a minute, this is a very, very important part of our government.
Absolutely. And I think those budget cuts certainly were disconcerting to us in Grant County, because with three huge copper mines and just the cuts to the enforcement division at EPA and just how much enforcement needs to happen at our Grant County mines for air quality, for water quality, hazardous waste disposal, toxics. I mean, it's just, the list goes on and on. It's a huge, huge thing. So what is the status in terms of going forward? Because we're under a continuing resolution right now. So what, the budget thing always, I think, is very confusing to people in terms of, we've got a continuing resolution to the end of September, but then this budget is for FY, fiscal year 2018. And what happens?
Well, the House has determined its proposed budget. You're right that both the budget's up in the air. Of course, the president maybe has a tax proposal that maybe is up in the air. You know, there has to be the question, sort of stepping back, of, well, why would you cut the EPA budget? You know, that you're not going to, with these cuts to what are relatively small domestic programs, you're not in any way going to affect the, you know, major expenditures of the United States government. So I think the cut wasn't, you know, the proposed cut was certainly about destroying the agency. And they were very clear about that. Even the cut that's coming out of the House is about hurting the effects of the agency. And the question, I think, for the country is, don't we want a government that consists of more than expanded military spending, which is expanded defense spending, which is what the president has proposed? Don't we want other sectors of our government to also be functioning? You know, for New Mexico, as a poor state, and there are a number of states that are situated the way we are, cuts on EPA's budget are passed down to the states, and we just can't afford that. And, you know, our state's economy is doing somewhat better, but I wouldn't be expecting legislators to make up the difference in the general fund budget. It's interesting, you know, for those who think that there's something the matter with environmental protection, you know, for the regulated industries, these cuts are going to slow down permitting times. And so, you know, that isn't actually in, one would think, in anyone's interest to have an EPA that doesn't function very well or an environment department that doesn't function very well. So we and so many organizations are asking members of Congress, you know, rebuild the EPA budget. But let's rebuild our country. Let's not cut Meals on Wheels. Let's not, you know, let's not do these cuts that, you know, we cuts in the Medicaid budget. Let's not take away some of the things that are working within our country for no very compelling purpose. And that's really got to be the message that gets across.
Mm-hmm. And so, how can people get involved? Is this campaign asking people to participate in some way?
Well, we are asking people to speak to their elected representatives in the Congress. But in addition, there are many things that are happening within EPA that are not directly about the budget. And there isn't, you know, we've talked about some of the rollbacks. Those are by no means all of the rollbacks that the administration is undertaking in terms of environmental regulation. They're actually happening so quickly one can barely keep up with them. But in each instance, you know, we, the public, have to speak to our elected representatives, try to get the support of every member from the delegation within New Mexico for this. And then we have to, as I said earlier, we've got to turn to the state legislature in some of these areas and say, it should be done by EPA, but if it's not getting done by EPA, we want to see the state able to do it as well.
Yeah, that's right. So remind us again of the URL.
It is very simple, friendsofepa.org.
All
and
right.
We have a Facebook. I feel like I'm just learning these things. So we have a little Facebook group, and we're putting a lot of stuff up on there. And I'm really heartened just to see how many people I don't know, but people around the country who are jumping in and saying things. There are a lot of groups that are working on this, on protecting, working on environmental protection within the state and nationally. And we're trying to help link those together. But I'd be happy to put people in touch with any organization, and there are many, many good organizations. I think people are working kind of as hard as they can right now as we get past this present moment in our country.
Right. So, Denise, just any final thoughts as we wrap up our interview and you think back to all the topics that we've talked about for the last hour?
I think we have no choice right now but to be optimistic that what's happening right now in national politics doesn't reflect what our country is. And if everybody in the country who feels that way works and is public and is gets out there and makes sure gets to town halls and all the other vehicles, it is still a democracy. And we need to use the tools of that democracy now to make our voices heard for the environment and for inequality and all the other things that are being affected that are really up in the air right now. So I'm very busy, but I'm actually really happy to be busy at this moment.
Very good. Well, Denise Fort, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. And thanks for taking the time to join us here on Earth Matters.
Thank you. It was great to be here, and I'll look forward to further occasions. Thank you.
For a podcast of today's program, visit the Earth Matters program page online at gmcr.org. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, 89.1 FM.